Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Well, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and I have the author of Next Generation of Halt and Haas, Kirk Gray, co-author, I should say, I think John Paskowitz, if I pronounce his name correctly. Kirk, just before we got online here, I asked you how the book was doing, how the sales were going in it. And I did notice that it's number 98 in some obscure category on Amazon.
I'll take any category.
All right.
As long as it's not fiction.
Well, before we get into the topic today, I know I put up a page about the book, and I'm going to send you a reminder to add some more details about the book and some like the back cover kind of text to that page at Ascendo under resources and Ascendo authors. But where should people go to find more information about the book?
Well, they can go to Wiley, and Wiley and Sons has it, and Amazon.com has it. My website, I appreciate people using the link through my website for Amazon, help support the website. But there's a couple that's basically the resources, and I'll certainly send you the information, some more information covering the subject material of the book. And I do appreciate you supporting it and putting it on your website. We hope lots of people utilize that.
Well, it's not my website. You're one of the many authors and contributors to the site. So, don't think of it as just mine.
Okay. Our website.
Yeah. AscendoReliability.com. And then you make sure we add the show notes both to the links, the various places you can find the book.
Right. It's a great resource and lots of information there at Ascendo.
So one of the things that's come up recently is I saw an article from Bloomberg. I think it's Bloomberg News. I'm not sure what publication it was out of them. A student sent me a link to an article about the Takata airbag inflators and the problems and the, I think it's up to like 60 million vehicles or something like that or under one form of recall or another. But the gist of the article was this the corporate culture of, to summarize it and probably to really oversimplify it, was that it's ship it. It's we don't, even though the engineers and technicians and manufacturing folks knew that there's problems, and many of them had raised flags and said, hey, this isn't right. This has got a failure mechanism that will really cause problems and probably kill people. And, you know, when you're looking back at an organization and you're looking at any product, there's always people that are saying, hey, this isn't right. And so it's some of it is how do you pay attention to that correctly? But I think part of the reason that they're in so much trouble, this Takata airbag issue, is that they had this steady, persistent culture of market growth and shipping it and taking essentially huge risks with the information that they had available. And even in some cases saying, we're going to ship anyway, even in the face of just compelling data that it was a problem. And eventually the government stepped in and said, hey, you got to recall this. And then it snowballed from there. But it reminded me of I think it was the Challenger explosion that had the O-ring. The engineers were saying, hey, this isn't right.
Don't fly at this temperature. We've never tested it, and we suspect there'll be problems.
But, part of the issue was that there wasn't necessarily this overt culture of launch anyway. It was in part how the information was presented and how compelling it was, how informative it was. But there's also cases you wrote about the GM ignition switch issue.
Right. You
know, was there a culture issue there about?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's so many mistakes. If you read that, and it's one of the few, you know, we rarely get exposure to causes of unreliability unless it's something like the National Transportation Safety Board, or it's an investigation like the Challenger accident, or somewhere that like the Boeing 777 battery problem catching fire. We rarely see information about the failures. So whenever we get that kind of information, I find it incredibly valuable. And the story of the GM ignition switch problem has so many layers of things that went wrong, from the engineer that changed the design and didn't change the part number, to the fact that it doesn't sound like it's a routine process in GM to just measure the torque of the switch, of the ignition switch, the force it requires to turn it on or off. And it was the engineers that went out to a junkyard and went to a fish and bait shop and grabbed a fish weighing scale and used that to measure the torque on the switches in the junkyard, and saw a significant difference in the torque pressure it needed to pull the switch out of its detent position. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, well, that just would be a natural test that I would perform. And looking at the variation of that force would be a key factor. And of course, you could go to a used car sales parking lot and find that almost immediately. I mean, you could certainly find plenty of samples to go measure, and it's not a destructive test. So that could have been easily done.
Well, in all of these cases, I mean, we're not going to test it in hindsight.
No.
In a car design, for example, whether it's an airbag or the ignition switch, or in a spacecraft, or any complex system.
Right.
And for that matter, your cell phone, right? There's thousands of ways it can fail, and we're certainly not going to test all of them.
No.
But why, like in this Bloomberg article, there was repeated warnings, repeated, you know, not necessarily formal FMEAs and saying, here's the information. The Challenger thinks that this is potentially a problem. But there's this culture of, well, we're going to take some risk and we can't do everything.
Right.
Right. And I think every organization has that to some degree or another. Now, here's the challenge, Kirk, is if you're in an organization and you find something like the O-ring issue with the Challenger, or that the keys have a much lower retention force than they should.
All right.
What do you do?
Well, I think you've seen in both those articles, the Challenger accident, the GM situation, the Takata airbag, that there is a culture, and in fact, it's very difficult to go and climb the administrative or management ladder to get to the person that can make that decision and understand. If you have an engineer up there at the top, it may be easier, but it's quite a challenge, because in particular, it's very difficult to prove in time something's going to happen. And, you know, the Takata guy said that this propellant would be unstable or become more possibly. I don't know. You read the article. I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, they knew it. Chemically, they knew it.
They knew chemically.
They knew it was going to be more explosive.
Right, in certain in high humidity over time, and I don't know what evidence they had to show to their management that this would be true. It's you know, it's, again, reliability is such a hard thing at especially in the design phase to bring to the table as something that could as something that needs to be fixed before the product ship, because it's a very time dependent and it may be way out there, as Takata is finding out. It also, both those situations with the airbag and the ignition switch were difficult to observe because they occurred when a severe situation occurred that, you know, the person could have been killed anyway, no matter if the airbag worked or the ignition switch had not turned into it turned off the airbag function when the ignition switch went out of its detent position. So these were in severe condition, so that, again, that was a real tough one.
Well,
to find.
Let's back it up to, let's say you're running a halt, for example, mm-hmm. or even easier, right? Any
right.
product development is, we get prototypes almost always, mm-hmm. right? We get we get three prototypes, we pull them up on the bench, and the engineering team says ready. The software guy wants one, the marketing guy wants one, you know, the development team wants theirs,
right?
And none of them start. None of them turn on.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
So what's the expected failure rate of that design and manufacturing process at that moment?
Expected failure rate is 100%.
Right. So they don't stop, right? They're going to say, all right, well, let's find out what's wrong. And they find out, oh, the power supply is not wired correctly. Or they find some root cause and they fix it and they move on.
Right.
Right. The issue is that process never ends. Right. And so I think that understanding that it's a learning process during development, that we have 100 functions we got to get right and tuned in and optimized, and failures are kind of getting in the way, and we solve failures as we go. That's just part of the process. Right. So even in a good organization that uses this build, test, fix kind of approach, they're going to have this sense that they always have failures. They just occur. But now, in that circumstance, let's say you find a failure and you recognize that with transportation vibration, for example, you put it on a halt chamber and 5G's RMS and it fails in 5 minutes. It's like, and you look at the failure mechanism, right? You look at exactly what it was and you go, this will always fail.
Right.
Right.
Those are the easy ones.
Those are the easy ones. But and you've been there where you show it to a mechanical engineer or to a management team and they go, oh, yeah, we need to fix that.
Right. Right. Right.
There's also times when we've done that. We find an issue. We bring it to people's attention and they say, oh, we can ignore that. That's a one time thing. Right.
Yeah, they can. And I've seen where they go through a list of things that are not functioning and they say acceptable to ship. And, you know, they've only found it on 1 out of 20 units on the bench. But I know when they produce a million of them, it's going to be, you know, if it's 1 out of 20, that's 2%?
5%, yeah.
5%, right. Quick math. It's going to be 5% of the product, and it may be even worse if whatever that mechanism that causes that underlying it, the physics, changes somewhat in the manufacturing process and could go quite high. It's probably not going to go much lower. I think with the Takata airbag in particular, and along with the exploding batteries that happened in
lithium ion battery, the early ones,
Yeah, those are very difficult to accelerate and without possibly bringing in irrelevant high level stresses. And I get from what you read in the article that the engineers knew and had tested and verified or something that the explosive the propellant would be over pressure or higher than it. Needed and caused the shrapnel, which was the causing of some people's deaths in the airbag incidents, of a shrapnel going through their neck or some vital function because the explosive was much too forceful.
Mm-hmm.
later. But that took I don't know how long the aging process took for that chemical to develop that, but it certainly took a long time for them to determine that that was an underlying cause in the field, I think, right?
No, they knew pretty quickly. I mean, it doesn't...
Who knew?
A part of the initial issue was that they thought they had just a bad batch, you know,
okay.
or it was a manufacturing variability that
right.
was isolated. But it's also, like you said, looking back many years at mm-hmm. processes that have changed locations and changed procedures and all kinds of things. So it was right. that was difficult. I agree.
Yeah.
The chemist looked at it and says, well, this base chemistry will do this. There's mm-hmm. not a mystery there. But I think the issue is that if you're in a culture, maybe that is facing many, many different potential, you know, career ending type failures. Mm-hmm. And the management teams are in the business of taking risks. They're mm-hmm. rewarded for being a risk taker and for charging ahead and shipping products and bringing in new customers.
That's right.
Right. So given that context, as a reliability engineer, just saying, hey, this is a risk is probably not enough. You know, mentioning it
no.
to somebody is not enough. Taking the details, you know, like coming out of a halt test and you have a burning fragment of what's left over of your product, you go, this failed, is a much more graphic way to present the failure. You know, if a solder joint breaks and you mm-hmm. have a proud electrolytic cap that swings, that's easy.
Well, maybe, but even there, you still have management telling you what? You overstressed it.
Well, you overstressed it, or how likely
right.
is that ever to occur?
Yeah,
and blah,
yeah
blah,
it's
blah,
never
going to
see that. It's never going to see that as induced fail
right.
condition.
And that's where our ability to talk about the details of the physics or chemistry or the failure mechanisms. You know, metal fatigue is real. It only
yes.
takes, you know, I did it once in a meeting. These guys were just not getting it. And
mm-hmm.
so I had an empty Coke can sitting there. So mm-hmm. I grabbed it and flexed it four times. And I said, it's the same as this,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right.
if I do it very slowly and at a very small angle, it just takes
right.
longer.
Right.
That's what we did. We've learned that this fatigues and it will fail.
Mm-hmm.
And the mechanical engineer's eyes got really big and like, oh, you know, yeah. I get it. And then he was on the side. So I think in part, what we do as reliability professionals, whatever level you are in the organization, is we look for failures. We're kind of the
well,
bad,
we do.
Right? We're kind of the bad
we
guys
do.
In that regard.
And management looks for reasons that the failure is relevant to the future in the field.
Right. And so part of what we need to do is make sure that our understanding and our argument that this is a problem or not a problem or what the true risk is part the science, right? But it's
yes.
also part the what does this mean to the business?
Right.
Right? So if you see something that's 1 in 20 mm-hmm. occurrence and it's roughly a 5% failure rate or
mm-hmm.
worse in the field, well, even that doesn't always help a manager understand it. But if you say,
no.
if every failure costs us $1,000, right?
Right.
And here's our shipment number and here's how many failures we're expecting. This is how much money it's going to come out. Then they can
right.
judge that as to other investments, other opportunities, what's the impact to profit, whatever it is that's important to them. Then it's in their language, right?
Right, making a business case out of it. But that, even that, Fred, is very difficult because some of the factors in the business case are non-quantifiable. I mean, how much, you know, Takata is the only one in the business, I think, or one of the most dominant. They've obviously made airbags for
not
decades.
Anymore.
And not anymore. I don't know who the alternative supplier is. But lost sales, corporate reputation, and, you know, that is a it's just not something that's quantifiable, but
oh, it is.
For sure.
It is, though.
Well,
it is.
How do you measure loss, future loss sales.
Well, the brand, the financial folks have put a value on brand, right? Okay. Just the brand reputation alone. Now, okay, it's not made up of just reliability, but it is a part of it, right?
Right.
So in some businesses, the quality and reliability is a significant portion of the brand's identity. And so it's industry and product line dependent, but talk to the finance folks, the ones that are putting together the spreadsheet, you know, the financials for the organization. Mm-hmm. There is a brand equity element to that.
Right.
What I did in one organization is we had annual customer satisfaction surveys.
Okay.
Right. The marketing people had built up a set of data that says if our customer satisfaction is at 80%, we can expect this many conversions of people that become aware of our product. So every 1,000 people that see our product, 2 will buy it. But okay, if we increase our customer satisfaction to 85% or to 90%, and they had some elaborate scale for measuring it,
yeah,
that it tripled the number of sales.
Okay. And they had data to back that up.
They had data to back that up. Most organizations run surveys. They do market analysis, right, and research. Now, what was key there and why I got involved was that the customer satisfaction number one driver, what was perceived as why it was a satisfactory product or not, was that it was reliable. It worked for, mm-hmm, 3 years as it was expected to work.
Right.
And so if the customers are defining the value of the brand is they make reliable products and that you have that relationship to customer satisfaction, you can look at future loss sales. If we ship a product that has a higher failure rate, that will directly reduce the customer satisfaction. You can measure that, right? And you can then say this will relate to this number of lost sales. And so it can be done. It's not trivial. It's not easy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it takes some assumptions, I think.
Well, it does. But you need friends in low places, like in marketing.
Well, they're pushing to get the product into the market, and you know, anything that holds that up is very painful, and especially on speculation of unreliability. Even though you can show them maybe the physics behind it, if they're engineers, they might understand that.
But even so, it's our job, I think, and it's in light of all of this cultural barrier to understanding the impact of potential failures, is, mm-hmm, to make that very, very clear in their language. So if it's in, right, money or in sales or in revenue or in brand promise or in customer satisfaction, whatever it is that our peers in the organization are using to make decisions, we need to convert our reliability values and estimates and so on into terms that they can understand. It doesn't mean it's easy.
No.
I'm never going to say that.
No.
But just saying that the failure rate is at 5%, that is out of context to how most other people make decisions.
Yeah, I guess I still find the speculation, unless you have a lot of data, and like you say, that you've tracked specific points in time where something changed about the product and you went out and made another customer satisfaction survey. You know, the correlation is not precise, but it could show you some case. I think that
what are you going to do instead, Kirk, to say, hey, it might fail and they're going to say ship it anyway and we'll find out? And then 9 times out of 10, you're fine, right?
Yeah. And you have that case where somebody says, okay, we shipped it. You warned us. You thought it was going to fail and it didn't. And, you know, 5 year, maybe like in the Takata airbag where products like automobiles are used for 10 years or 5 to 10 years or more, that mechanism took that long to become dangerous,
yeah,
and cause the deaths.
I can see them saying, "Hey, I told you so," but you're right. At 5 years, the engineer would look foolish.
Right. So yeah, the question is, I told you so. And, you know, by that time, your management may have changed three times. Who knows? That's another part of it. It's very a lot of companies are very dynamic, especially in the high technology industry. And I don't know about Takata, but certainly the GM switch issue came about, only discovered many, many years after it had actually been the mechanism that caused the failures had been changed. Mm-hmm. And it was a very long period of time. So, you know, a lot of people got away with it sort of in a way for a long time and didn't suffer any cost of a job or whatever.
That's right, or reputation or anything else.
Reputation, it's very long-term. Reliability is a very long-term issue, unlike testing on a bench and finding a patent defect or a patent failure right there. You know, that's you correct that right away.
Yeah, it's having the smoking gun makes the argument a lot easier. Like, hey, look. But let's wrap it up there. I'll have to remember to send you the link to that Bloomberg article, and we'll add it in the show notes. And back to your article on the GM ignition switch and the mm-hmm. report and a couple other things we mentioned. But it's something we all face as a reliability professional, is that we're finding things that are going wrong or potentially going wrong. And then what do we do about it? So if you are a listener, if you're thinking that somewhere in your organization, there's this future Takata switch level of issue, what are you doing about it? How are you addressing this? How are you getting your resume ready, or are you, doing what you're told and driving on, or are you raising the red flag? And or what's the right approach? How do you communicate effectively that you have a future class defect that's going to wipe out the whole product line?
All right. You're going to definitely have to duck some bullets as you bring that information.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And it's, I don't know that I have a good answer for that. I've run into this circumstance a few times, and I'm not sure if it was I was talking to the right person or I had a good argument. I don't know. But if you've got ideas, or if you've been through this and any advice to add, leave a comment or a review, leave some notes on the show page, and share what you could do to solve this problem, to avert these major kind of defect problems. So with that, Kirk, let's wrap this one up.
Okay. Thanks, Fred. It's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.